Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back inside the studios at KATE 1450. We've got another interview for you here, as there's no sports going on right now. We've taken the time to talk to some sports figures from around Minnesota about their stories in sports as a whole. And this one has quite a long story to tell, and I'm looking forward to hearing all of it. Dick Jonkowski joins us over the phone now. Dick, thanks for taking some time to talk to us for a little bit. If you don't know Dick, you've gone to a Minnesota Gophers baseball or basketball game anytime before 2017, you've at least heard his voice. He was the PA announcer for the Gophers for more than 30 years, and he also picked up the nickname the Polish Eagle, which is somewhere I want to start, Dick. You got the nickname at a job at a car dealership, and it's apparently a place where everybody had a nickname. It came off as something that was a little cheesy to me and not something that would make me want to buy a car. Did the nickname help you sell cars at all?
No, Nate. Thank you for asking me to be on. I appreciate it. No, actually, I didn't last very long. The situation was Malkerson Motors in Shakopee, which was owned by Les Malkerson, who was a board of regents at the time, and also his son-in-law was the general manager, Al Fisher, who was a halfback on the second Rose Bowl team at the University of Minnesota in 1962. But I was working with the Minnesota Muskies in the American Basketball Association in public relations. And after that first year, they left and went to Miami to become the Miami Floridians. And the Pittsburgh Pipers won the league that year, and they moved from Pittsburgh to Minnesota. And in the meantime, I had to get a job for about 3 months. And so I went to Al Fisher, and I asked him, I could say, you know, he said, do you ever try to sell cars? I said, no, I never have. But he said, you're a decent, pretty good personality. You should do okay. And, well, and then I took the job, and I was introduced to the sales manager, a guy by the name of Stan Dirks. And he said, Dick, you're going to have to get a nickname. Every one of our salesmen, all six of them now, will have to have a nickname. So he said, let's see. So he started out with me being Polish. He said, you're Polish. I said, right. And he said, you love sports. He said, who are some of your favorite teams? And ironically, most of my favorite teams aren't in Minnesota. You know, I'm a big Philadelphia Phillies fan, Philadelphia Eagles, Detroit Red Wings. I like the Boston Celtics and the Utah Jazz in basketball. And for some reason, he said, Philadelphia Eagles, he said, in Polish. He said, I think it'll rhyme, or it'll work out really well. Let's call you the Polish Eagle. And that was in 1968. So that's how it started, but it really didn't help me sell cars because I didn't last very long. They were nice enough to keep me on for the full 3 months, but I don't think I really earned my keep in that time.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds better than the Polish Red Wing, I'd say. A little bit, yeah.
So, yeah, that name is that. It's amazing how every place I go, that's how I'm introduced. Nick Jankowski, the Polish Eagle.
It was only 3 months, though. What happened to let the nickname stick so well for the rest of your career? Did you embrace it after a certain point, or was it just when you moved on from place to place, people knew you as that just from what you had with the car dealership?
Yeah, no, I think I just kept it because people liked it. You know, people say, that's a unique name. So I just kept it, and then I was in radio, you know, for so many years. And that was always, I started out in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, and then came to Shakopee and New Prague and whatever. But the name is always there. And even today, when I speak, although it's been nothing going on, as you know, right now at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, even in the near future, I don't have anything booked at all. It's really been tough. But he still is Dick Jonkowski, known as the Polish Eagle. That's kind of how they do it.
Now, I did want to ask, and you mentioned before, and we'll talk more about just kind of how you got started getting interested in sports when you were young, but your teams are from all over the place. The Red Wings in Detroit, the yeah. Celtics are in Boston, the Phillies in Philadelphia, and then the Eagles there too.
Right.
What led you to pick up those teams when you were growing up as your favorites from all over the place? Because, I mean, so many people are just Minnesota fans or from Minnesota. I'm a Chicago guy. I'm Cubs, not White Sox, Blackhawks, Bulls, and all that.
Yeah. I
mean, what led
yeah.
to you having such a variety?
Well, I don't know. As a kid, the Phillies, for instance, I was 7 years old in the 1950 World Series against the Yankees and the Phillies. And I remember that I didn't know the players, but I loved that pinstripe uniform that the Phillies had, the red, you know, with the red pinstripes. It was a very attractive uniform. And then, of course, I fell in love with Richie Ashburn and Robin Roberts and Del Ennis and all those guys. And I just started following them, you know, from then on. And I still follow the Phillies fairly closely to be honest. It's amazing. Same with the Eagles, but the Eagles don't go back to 1960 when they beat the Packers in the championship game with Norm Van Brocklin, Chuck Bednarik, or Tommy McDonald. And I was so happy because everybody hated the Packers even then. And, of course, that has stuck with me with the Eagles, and I was very happy when they won the Super Bowl here, of course, a couple years ago. That was a big thrill for me. And the Celtics were always a team as a kid that I, as a little kid, I tried to imitate Bob Cousy with the behind-the-back dribble, behind-the-back pass. I tried to be a real hot dog. And I just fell in love with the Celtics. They won, you know, 8 championships in a row, 11 to 13 years. And I just can't. I still follow, but I don't follow the Celtics like I used to because I don't really know the players as well. I know who they are, but I guess the day-to-day stuff I don't do. Mm-hmm. And as far as the Red Wings, Gordie Howe and Alex Delvecchio were two guys that I just really loved. And I think originally I looked at the logo, that winged wheel on their jersey, and I fell in love with that before I knew who the players were. So that's really how it is. You know, I'm still a Twins fan or Vikings, North Stars. In those days, I was a big North Star fan. I don't follow the Wild very closely, I have to be very honest. I was a Lynx fan up until everybody left. Now I don't go to their games either, follow them. And the Timberwolves, to a degree. But so it's just different. People just say that to me, same thing you did. How can you be a fan of all these other towns when you live in Minnesota?
Well, it's a good story there, and I want to go back even further. And again, we'll talk about your history behind the mic in a moment, but going back to when you were young, just growing up, what were some of your first exposures to sports? Were you a player early on? Did you play sports to a certain level in high school or anything like that? And then what was it that made you fall in love with all the different games out there?
Well, yeah, as a kid, I played Little League, Pee Wee's first, everything. We moved around so much. My dad was a theater operator, owned small town theaters. And so we had theaters in River Falls, Wisconsin, Excelsior, Minnesota, Wabasso, Minnesota, down by Redwood Falls, and also one in New Prague, where I went to high school. And he also had other jobs with Jed Malievo. So we moved a lot. But when I was in first grade until I was in ninth grade, we moved 6 times. So I just make friends, and all of a sudden we're leaving. But I played all those sports. I was lucky. I went to the state tournament in Little League baseball when I was at Excelsior. Went to the state tournament in Babe Ruth baseball, also in Excelsior when I was 13 at St. Cloud. And then we went to the American Legion State Tournament when I played in New Prague when I was 17 years old, and that was at Midway Stadium in St. Paul. And I was fortunate. I played 1 year of minor league baseball in Salisbury, North Carolina, and it was Class D baseball at that time. They don't have Class D anymore. But actually, I shouldn't say I played a whole year because I didn't. I only played part of the year, and then they sent me home. They felt I'd never be a good enough hitter to advance. They said, your fielding is very good, but we don't think you'll ever be a good enough hitter. And that's really the reason I got into radio, because when I got back to New Prague, everybody says, hey, Dick, you love sports. Why don't you go to Brown Institute for radio broadcasting and specialize in sports? So that's what I did in 1964. Graduated in November and then started in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, my first job, in January of 1965, and then from there moved on to Shakopee a couple years later and worked at New Prague for a while. And that really kind of got me started also in the public address announcing. Mm-hmm. Being a radio announcer, people said, could you do this? Would you do our football games? Whatever it might be.
Tell us a little bit about the experience at Brown Institute. I mean, when you say you specialize in sports, was there a program in there where you were able to focus more on sports? I mean, now there's so many things. I went to Syracuse, which has a great program for it.
Yeah.
Northwestern has a great program for sports broadcasting. There's others around there, too. Ball State's done really well over the past few years developing it. But when you were doing it way back when, what was it like to be someone who, again, was majoring in radio with that emphasis in sports? What did all that entail?
Well, you had to do the regular programming and records and all the rest. But we had a gentleman by the name of Randy Norris, who actually was all into the sports end of it. We actually got to take a tape recorder to Metropolitan Stadium and announce games as part of our homework or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And then they critique us on the play-by-play and that type of thing. So I was really lucky. I was there at a good time. And we had the newsroom, you know, it was just like a regular newsroom with all the teletype going to be heck. And so I would, like during the World Series in 64, when the Cardinals played the New York Yankees, I remember playing like I was reporting for one of the locker rooms. And you could hear the teletype in the background, Harry Carey type stuff. You know, I was trying to give a play with Cardinals win. I remember Ken Borey hit a grand slam home run, and I had some crowd noise in the background, and just kind of went into the whole deal. And it was right up my alley. And then at the same time that I was going to Brown Institute, I was an usher for the Twins and the Vikings at Metropolitan Stadium. So I kind of had a twofold reason to go there. I got to know everybody, and I think eventually that helped me get some of the jobs in, like with the Minnesota Muskies, Minnesota Pipers, and the ABA, and that helped me because people knew who I was. And just all the way around, it just seemed to work out really well. I guess I could thank a lot of people that helped me. Paul Giel, the great star and All-American in football and baseball, he hired me originally in 1986 for basketball. It was Clem Haskins' first year as a coach, and Julie Pearl, who had been there 50 years in basketball and 60 in football, unbelievable. He felt like he was, well, a detriment because he couldn't see the drive, and he didn't want anybody to haul him around. So he told Paul, he said, I'm going to retire, find somebody for basketball. So I worked out because I'd been MC'd a lot of things for the university, for the Williams Fund, and Paul said, I'm going to give you a chance. He said, I should open it up to tryouts, but he said, I like what you've done for us. I'm going to give you a chance. If you hit it off with Clem Haskins, the job is yours. And ironically, Clem loved NBA trivia and stuff like that, and so did I. And so when I first met him, right, it didn't take long, and we were great friends right away. And by the end of the night, he said, I'll tell you what, if Paul Giel okays you, I certainly want you. So that started that way, and then Julie was doing football the following fall, but he ended up with blood clots in his lungs, so he had to give up football. So they put me in there halfway through the season. So I actually did 10 years of football also at the Metrodome. And then in 1988, John Anderson hired me to do Gopher baseball. So I really was, I guess, at the right place at the right time.
Now, I usually when we start these things off, I go over just kind of who we're talking to, what they've done. But I started to look into yours, and the list is just so long and extensive, Dick, that I feel like I'd be missing anything out. So could you just quickly, before we get into more of what you've done in MCing and all that, give us a kind of maybe shortened summary of just everything that you've been able to do over the course of your career?
Sure. It's well, the radio part, of course, started in 1965, and I did that really up until about 87 full-time, and shocked me, knew Craig, whatever it was be. Then I was doing a lot of public speaking at that time, and my wife and I decided, why don't you try and get into the public speaking full-time? I was taking a chance, however, but the radio was down to very little that I was doing. I was only doing sports at that time, and I couldn't live on that. So actually, I started putting my name out there with I had an agent that worked for me part-time in those days, and started doing banquets of all types of Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Waterfall, Pheasants Forever, Deer Hunters, all that type of stuff. And they paid probably maybe $200 a night. But then it gradually got up to as high as 400, maybe even 500 sometimes. So it just went from one thing to the other. I ended up as a ring announcer with Vern Gagne from 83 to 89 in the old AWA. Mm-hmm. And I did Minnesota Norsemen professional softball. I did public address. The Minnesota Phillies women's basketball. Cold throat. Also, any organization that started up, it seemed like they called me to do the public address. The Minnesota Monarchs in volleyball. I did the Minnesota Buckskins at the Met Center. That was professional tennis. And so, Don Cassidy of the Twins at that time, their promotions director, said, if you want your organization to fail, hire Dick Jankowski. Because almost every group that I was with ended up leaving town after a short time. So it really was kind of a crazy situation. But yeah, I was so fortunate to get one thing after another and just keep going. Even today, I still do a lot of speaking and certain group events that I do every year. And I think I don't know what it's been, but the amateur baseball Hall of Fame dinner that's at St. Cloud every September. I've done, I started in 1979, and I've only missed two since 1979. So some of these things are ongoing, which I'm really fortunate to have.
And, well, that's part of what it is. To your credit, too, it seems like you've been able to find one thing after another, but at the same time, you've been willing to do one thing after another, too, and really switch up what you've done as well. I mean, just for instance, one thing that stuck out, working with the AWA, that's kind of a different avenue, a unique kind of thing, working as a ring announcer for that. I want to ask, how is that different than everything else that you did, and what was the adjustment that you make doing that compared to, well, all the other traditional sports things that you had done?
Yeah, that, it really was a Bert Gagne. I was lucky there because he lived in Excelsior when I was playing Little League Baseball, and then he kind of followed me all the way up through all the stuff I did and all the emceeing I did. And it's an amazing thing when you think about it, because I had three bosses, basically. Vern, Wally Carbo, and Greg Gagne would all tell me what to do before the matches start. So one guy would say this, one guy would say that. So usually I listened to Wally, because Wally was pretty honest with me. What happens a lot of times is they don't tell the ring announcer when they, then the wrestlers are going to go after them or rip their shirts or whatever they might do. You know, but Wally would tell me, Dick, as soon as you announce their guys, get the hell, as he said, get the hell out of there, because you, otherwise you're going to be attacked. So, boy, he helped me a lot of times or I would have been nailed. But I got out, wanted to jump out of the ring and just make it out of, they come after me, even though they weren't going to hurt me. At least I didn't think so. But at, I only was knocked out of the ring one time that I can recall, and that was in the old St. Paul Civic Center. 18,000 people, the Road Warriors, and they were going against Greg Gagne and Curt Hennig. And I was introducing the Curt Hennig and Greg Gagne, and as I was introducing them, Hawk and the Road Warriors came through the ropes, threw a punch over my shoulder, and knocked me through the ropes out of the cement. I didn't hit my head, but I kind of went along with the act, and I got up, and I started staggering, and I felt for blood. And my son was 8 years old, sitting in the front row, jumped up on his chair. He said, Dick, you pony, or Dad, you pony, you big pony. And the people just cracked up. They just went nuts because they could see that I was just putting on an act. So a few times I saw a lot of guys get hurt because it does happen. You know, most of it's scripted. But, gee, I saw guys get bleed the beat heck, and one couple guys get knocked out. I remember Nick Bockwinkel really got knocked out one time, and they had to bring the stretcher and the ambulance and Craig. So it does happen, but it's a unique profession. It's all changed now since we don't have it here anymore, and I don't even follow it. But I got to know Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, the Crusher, the Bruiser, all those guys kind of became your friends, you know, because out of the ring they're completely different people. Mm-hmm. So you get guys that you really still, even today, Kenny J, who's still alive, he was a guy that never won a match, I don't think. He lost all the time. But I still see him on occasion, and Eddie Sharkey and guys that were involved in the old AWA.
Yeah, that's funny. It's a really good story about going having guys go after you. I mean, that's not something you would imagine when you get into the business, having to deal with, for sure.
No, absolutely. I was going to mention one thing about the radio. That you're in it, you know how things work with different guys, people, different owners. Well, I did know it at the time, but the guy that hired me at Ladysmith, Wisconsin, was named Chuck Nelson, and it was WLDY, 1,000-watt station. And he called me after I graduated November at Brown Institute. I was living with my folks in New Prague, and he called me one day and said, Hi, my name is Chuck Nelson, general manager of the WLDY in Ladysmith. I hear you know a lot about sports. I said, well, I think I do. He said, name the Chicago Cardinal Dream backfield. Now, I don't know if you ever heard, they had a backfield in the 50s. Mm-hmm. They had Paul Crispin, Pat Harder, Charlie Trippi, Angsman, Elmer Angsman, and those guys were called the Chicago Cardinal Dream backfield. And I rattled it off to him. He says, okay, name the four horsemen. I said, let's see if I can remember. Harry Stuhldreier, Jim Crowley, there was Don Miller, and Elmer Layden. He said, that's right. He said, you're hired. Unbelievable. He said, be here Sunday. You're going to start Monday morning. And I thought, I can't believe this. I told my dad. My dad was very skeptical. He said, "Dick, I'll tell you, I'll go with you. I don't trust. It doesn't sound very good. It doesn't sound right." So he went down to Lee's with me. We met with Chuck Nelson, and we went with him for about an hour. And he told my dad, he said, "There's a motel here. Dick will stay here tonight and the next couple of nights." He said, "I think everything's all set." So my dad left and went back to Shakopee, or New Prague, where he was living. I'm sorry. Went back to New Prague. As soon as he left, Chuck Nelson comes up to me. "You're not staying at a motel. You're staying in my attic." So he takes me upstairs in the attic, and I sleep up there. And, you know, he had a radio station in those days, Sunrise Sunset. And I think they still do on occasion, a lot of them. I'm not sure, though. But it was Sunrise Sunset, so he had to be off the air at a certain time. So he puts me to bed like 8 o'clock, gets me up at 10, goes down and turns the station on, which is illegal. He said, "I want to see if you could do records, if you could read commercials." And he said, "Let's see if you can do it." Holy crap. So I'm out there. I did 4 or 5 records and introductions, commercials. He said, "All right, that's enough." He said, "Go." So I went back and got 2 hours sleep, came back at 5 o'clock in the morning, and signed on the air at 6, all by myself, just trying to get through it. And I should have known that that was a bad deal, because after almost every day, he'd come in when he'd get off the air and he'd want me to go to a bar with him and have drinks. And I said, "Chuck, I don't drink." "Yeah, you're coming." So I went with him a few times. But this one time we went to a place called the Club 8 right outside of Ladysmith. And we walked in. And just as we walked in, 6 people that were sitting at a booth got up and walked out before they even ordered. So the bartender came over. He said, "Chuck, I have to tell you, they left because of you. They don't like you." And Chuck said, "That's defamation of character. Dick, you'll testify, right?" I said, "I really can't." He said, "You're fired. Give me your keys." So I handed him my keys, and the other people at the radio station said, "Ah, don't worry. That's when he gets drunk, goes on a tangent. You'll be signing on tomorrow morning." Well, it didn't work that way. He called me that night at where I was staying. He said, "Stop at the station on your way out of town. I have a severance check for you." But he said, "You're all through." Unbelievable. So I lost the job that quick with no severance pay except for that little bit that he gave me. And luckily, I had some friends working at KSMM in Shakopee, and they lost their sports director, and so I just kind of came at the right time there and started doing sports and records and selling time, and so it worked out. But I'll tell you, working for an alcoholic was one of the toughest things I've ever done.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I understand the business. You do what you got to do, but I'm lucky to say I haven't had to deal with anything quite like that in my time so far.
Well, I'm happy you haven't, I'll tell you there.
All right, Dick, well, we've had a long talk already. We haven't even gotten into what Minnesota fans know you best for, which is, of course, being the PA announcer for Minnesota basketball and baseball for more than 30 years. And the PA announcer gig is kind of unique when it comes to covering teams, in that you've got your newspaper writers and, of course, no cheering in the press box. And then there's the play-by-play guys, and they're allowed to get enthusiastic about things, especially if they're broadcasting for the team. But the PA announcer has that unique role where he can really, really get emotional about it and rile up a crowd when he says, you know, "Whoever for three" and all that kind of stuff, and really get people into it. Have you always had that kind of rile-em-up mentality and personality in you?
Well, I guess to a degree. I would say I still do Shakopee games, you know, baseball, football, softball, whatever. But yeah, I always had the enthusiasm. I never really thought, when I was a Boy Scout usher at Memorial Stadium and also at Williams Arena, and listening to Julie Pearl, that I ever would do that. We used to imitate him because he had that nasally voice, and he got by with murder. If somebody asked me one time when I was doing the Gophers, would Julie Pearl do well in today's society? I said, they wouldn't let him work. And I say that because he did not have a boss. I mean, he did what he wanted. I remember one of the games I was doing, the ushering at Williams Arena, Gophers were playing Indiana, and there was a timeout call, and he started to read the commercials like we always had to do, and the band started playing. He said, "Will the band please shut up?" Right on the PA. If I did that, I'd have been fired in a minute. That was one thing, and he just did what he wanted. At football, this is a true story, there was a squirrel in the end zone at Old Memorial Stadium. And the crowds were, you know, it was close to game time, maybe 10, 15 minutes from the start of the game. So the stadium was almost full. and he gets on the PA. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, your attention. There's a squirrel on the field. A squirrel and a squirrel started running down the field, right, just like going for a touchdown." So he's got it. He goes, and Julie gets on the PA and says, "All right, he's at the 50, the 40, the 30, the 20, the 10, the 5. He scores!" And the people jumped up like it was a game and cheered. It was just unbelievable. I'll never forget it as long as I live. But he was a crazy guy, and he got in some trouble with some of the things he said at the state tournaments and lost his job even before he lost the Gopher ones. But a nice man, because I'll say when I took over for him, he said, if they don't treat you right, Dick, let me know. Make sure they treat you right. And I'll never forget that. He was just a very kind person.
Well, you never really told the band to shut up or anything like that, Dick, but you did
build
up this reputation for being able to have some humor and throw a couple of quick jabs in there every now and then. I was watching earlier you tell a story about how once the Gophers had two players named Lewis and Clark come in, and you were able to put that one together real quick when you were announcing it. Where do you get that humor from? Because it's so many people try to be funny while they're doing this kind of stuff, but a lot of times if a play-by-play broadcaster does it on TV, it'll come off as just cheesy or just flat-out kind of lame. What do you do, and how do you build up that kind of humor and cleverness in a way that people came to love?
You know, I've always had that ability. I say it's a God-given ability because even as a kid at New Prague High School, I would do the pep fest. I'd emcee the pep fest. I didn't have any notes at all, everything off the top of my head. And all the teachers said, "Well, you've got a gift. You've got a gift. Make sure you use it." And so that's, with the sports and the humor and trying to entertain people, the Red Skelton, the great comedian of years ago, I'm sure you've heard of, he would just come out with one-liners, and he always said somebody laughing at something he said is worth more than $1 million to me money-wise. And I feel the same way. Even today when I do banquets and so forth, I look for the humor. You know, I like that guy. I see a bald guy in the audience. I said, so-and-so combed his hair for 20 minutes, and he forgot to bring it. You know, stuff like that. Just crazy, say one-liners. I remember a guy was about a 300-pounder, and I said he never learned how to swim because you have to wait an hour after you eat. You know, just things like that, and people, they love that kind of thing. It seems to go over. And so I've taken a lot of stuff from comedians like Red Skelton, Henny Youngman, Rodney Dangerfield, whoever they might be, and try to use them wherever I can. You know, Deer Hunters banquets, just great stuff, just a chance to make people laugh. And I find that different professions are easier than some of them. Even churches, I have these jokes for the priests all the time, different things. And now even with this the corona thing, you know, there have been things that I've been trying to come up with to stay alive, I guess, to keep a sense of humor. The other day, a lady came walking toward me, and she was wearing a mask, and I wasn't. And she said, "Where's your mask?" I said, "Who do you think I am, a Lone Ranger?" And she cracked up. She just laughed to beat heck. So there's always something, I think, if you really look for it, in the humor. But I have to admit, I've been very, very fortunate to be able to do that right off the cuff.
Well, Dick Jonkowski joining us here on KATE Radio, telling stories about all of his times in sports. And it's been real fun getting to go over some of this stuff with you, Dick. You've spent more than 30 years down on that court at Williams Arena and at the baseball field as well. You were right there, courtside or up in the booth, seeing all of it. What's some of, and again, you don't, maybe not just one, but a few of your favorite memories over the time that you were able to be just right there in the middle of the action with the Gophers?
There have been a lot of great ones. I'll tell you that. When I think about one of the big ones, it was a Super Bowl Sunday afternoon, and we beat Indiana by 50 points, and Bobby and I were going absolutely crazy. So that was a great thrill. We beat Iowa in a triple overtime game with Vashawn Leonard. That's the game where I actually almost passed out. I was so riled up in the game, and when the game ended, I guess it's like a desk in front of me at courtside, and I laid down and I had trouble breathing, and people, cripe, they thought I had a heart attack. But I just got that much into the game itself. We had Ricky Birdsong. We remember that when he came out of the stands or came out of the off the coaching bench and ran up in the stands, and he was coaching Northwestern and sat with people in the stands. And then at the end of the game, he came down and he yelled at me. He said, "We won the game." I said, "No, you didn't. You got beat by 10 points." He said, "You changed that scoreboard." I said, "I can't. I don't have anything to do with the scoreboard." He said, "You changed that scoreboard. We won." And he would not leave the court. Finally, we got some policemen to come and grab him and take him off the court. And sadly, about 3 months later, he was killed while jogging in Chicago, but hit by a car. But I'll never understand that situation, and I don't think anybody else will. And then we've had people run on the court. You know, the last time I think we had the people actually run on the court. But when we beat Indiana in 2013, when they were number one in the nation, boy, that was a thrill. People jumped over the top of me. One lady kicked me in the head. She didn't know she did it, but nailed me right in the head as she's trying to get on the court. So there have been a lot of things that the average person will never see or never even hear about. You know, it's just been each time it's kind of an unusual situation because something could, you never know what's going to happen. Whether it's a referee making a mistake or falling. The second game I ever did, Ed Hightower was an official. I don't know if you remember him or not, but he was a very tough guy. And there was a play where a guy by the name of Grady Mateen from Ohio State came down the floor and dunked the ball, and he hung on the rim after he dunked the ball. And I pointed to Ed Hightower, I like the dunk sign. He's hanging on the rim. He came running over to me, stopped the game, and he said, "Hey, you announce, I'll referee. One more gesture like that," he said, "you're done. I'll kick you out of here." So I learned a quick lesson there because I was kind of a cheerleader to start with. But at the same time, if there's a real exciting play or we win the game on a last-second shot, yeah, I was really more than a fan than an announcer in those particular instances, I think. And I still would do it today because I don't know. I just think you get the fan into the game and they like it. They like the opportunity. I think a deadpan guy is not really what you want to be. And Joe Buck, the announcer, of course, you know who he is. He married my niece. And I have a book out. I don't know if you've seen my book or not, but he did a great job. He did the foreword for the book, and so did Mike Max. And my book has a lot of stuff that you'd like, over 60 jokes, pictures of people I worked with in the years in sports, Brooks Robinson, Stan Musial, John Stockton, Rick Berry, all these people. So the book is selling well, and I'm very glad that I did it, thanks to my wife. If not for her, I never would have done it. But it's really turned out extremely well. So I'm really very thankful for the long career I've had. I'm now 76 years old. I still like to do the announcing, still like to do the MC or public speaking or whatever it might be. So I hope I can still do it for a while.
Yeah, the book, by the way, called It's All About Me, and you can get it, of course, at thepolisheagle.com. Dick Jonkoski joining us here on KATE Radio. It's, again, been real fun to be able to hear some of these stories. Dick, I'm just starting out, and I hope that one day I can have half of what you just told us here in this half hour or so that we've been able to have you. It's been a pleasure to have you on and be able to hear from you and tell these stories just of your entire experience through emceeing and doing PA and then radio as well. I hope we can talk again at some point, but it's been real, real fun to talk to you right now just about everything that you've done.
Well, Nate, I'll tell you, I've been to Albert Lea and spoken a few times at different banquets, and I've enjoyed that town. Great town, great sports town. I was a big Austin fan as a kid. Loved the Austin Packers when I was in high school. But you have a terrific voice, by the way, for radio. And all I can say is any help I can give you along the way, I still have a lot of contacts as you move up or whatever you want to do. Make sure you keep my number and don't hesitate to call.
Well, I appreciate that, Dick, and that's one of the things I love about doing this in this business. It seems like everyone's always willing to help, and I know that it's obvious with your personality and just how nice you are that I know I can call you whenever I'd like. Dick Jonkoski joining us here on KATE Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to KATE 1450.